Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Mouth.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Loneliness is a rich vein for art. How many songs, novels, poems, photographs, and other works have put the painful absence of connection squarely in front of us? The writer Olivia Lang found herself overwhelmed with loneliness after moving from England to New York City for a relationship that ended abruptly. Rather than deny her wish for connection, she dived into the experience of urban isolation and into the lives of several artists whose desolation fueled their work, mainly Edward Hopper, Andy Warhol, David Wojnarowicz, and the outsider artist Henry Darger. Her book is called The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone, and Olivia Lang is with us from a very busy studio in the UK. And Olivia, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you for having me.
Now, you found yourself alone in New York City after moving there for a relationship that ended very quickly. How did being in the city make the loneliness feel more acute?
I think the thing about being in a city is you're surrounded by people constantly. You're very hyper aware of other people's lives, particularly in a city like New York, where it's very crowded, it's very cramped. You're looking out of your window at an awful lot of other windows. So you have this kind of privileged visual view of people's lives. And if your own life is kind of unpopulated, unfulfilled, you can get strong visual information about how rich other people's lives are. You see people with their husbands and their kids and their wives. And, you know, you're aware that you're kind of the odd one out in that situation. I think one of the hallmarks of the experience of loneliness is a feeling of extreme exposure and shame. And there's something about existing in an urban environment where you feel hyper exposed to other people's eyes, that you're very much revealed in your state of vulnerable loneliness.
Well, you decided not to deny this essential part of the human condition, the loneliness, but to really dig into it, including doing some research on loneliness. There's a lot, it seems, on the physiological effects, but there's almost this phobic avoidance of loneliness in study, and it gets pathologized in certain ways. How do you think loneliness becomes pathologized?
I think it absolutely does get pathologized. And I mean, the psychological research that's been going on in the last 20 years is really stunningly interesting. And it does tell us a lot about how dangerous loneliness, the experience and feeling of loneliness, can be to the human body. But at the same time, while I was reading all that material, I was noticing how ashamed it often made me feel for being lonely, that it was very normative. It was talking about social connection as the normal state and loneliness as the abnormal state. And I kept thinking, well, you know, an awful lot of people inhabit this state, and often for very good reasons. It's not a shameful or a wrong state to be in. We are all at some point in our lives going to lose people and feel loneliness and longing. That's just part of being human.
And there is a kind of cycle there. I mean, we turn and flee when we get a whiff of loneliness or need from others, especially from strangers, which, as we learn in your book, makes people feel all the more isolated and more aggressive and more angry and less likely to be able to connect.
Absolutely. It's such a vicious cycle. And there's a scene in the book where I'm talking about having encountered somebody at a railway station, an elderly man, when I was kind of in my early 20s, and I was reading a book, and he sat beside me and he kept trying to strike up a conversation. He was smiling. He was pleasant. But the loneliness pouring off him was so absolutely overwhelming that I couldn't really bring myself to speak to him. And I have shame to this day about how poorly I treated him. And I think we've all been familiar with that experience, probably on both sides, of being the one who's lonely and can feel that driving people away, but also of the person who's in a socially contented state and thinks, oh God, this lonely person is just draining me. I can't give them what they need.
You explore artists who look at brokenness and unbelonging and turn it into work. Edward Hopper, Billie Holiday, the outsider artist Henry Darger, Andy Warhol, someone we think of as perpetually surrounded by an entourage of attractive people. What made him a study in loneliness?
Yeah, I think all those people just had so much to, I think they dignified loneliness in their work. I think they made it apparent that it was something worth looking at. And of all of them, Warhol was the one that I was most surprised by. Like you, I see, like all of us, I mean, we see him as the social artist of the 20th century. He really was a consummate socialite. But at the same time, he was somebody who struggled deeply with intimacy, who found he was incredibly shy, even towards the end of his life. He found contact very hard. He was a gay man. He did have some relationships, but often not as fulfilling as he really wanted them to be. And he, I think, made all kinds of interesting work about loneliness. But the thing that I was most struck by, especially for our sort of 21st century moment, is the way that he used technology and machinery to sort of to handle his own struggle with intimacy. So he would use tape recorders, cameras, film cameras, as ways of sort of brokering and buffering connection. They would let him both be close to people, to be able to talk to the people that he wanted to, the beautiful people that he was so attracted to. But at the same time, they let him stare at a bit of a distance. He could go to a party with his camera, and there's Andy with his camera taking photos. He's not vulnerable to, will he stand alone? Will nobody come and talk to him? He's made himself into something else. So the way those machines sort of protect him made me think so much about how we use smartphones and computers in our own times.
Yeah, that's a big theme in the book, that kind of way that we retreat into something else. But something else that struck me, a sort of theme that has to do with Andy Warhol's work, the kind of idea that of the sameness, you know, like he pumps out this art, like, what does he say? All the Cokes are the same and all the Cokes are good, you know?
Yeah,
Coke can be drunk by coal miners and movie stars. And here he is, like, creating this idea that everything could be the same. And there is a sameness outside of loneliness, these cookie-cutter images of how lives are supposed to be, coupled in groups. In fact, I think at one point you call it the shiny factory of monogamy, you know?
So, yeah, I was in a bad mood at the time.
But there's this homogenized world that is tremendously isolating for some of these artists. I'm thinking of David Wanarovich. First, tell us a little bit about him and what is revealed in his work.
He died of AIDS in 1992 at the age of 37, very young. And he'd come from a violent childhood. He'd been homeless. He'd been a sex worker as a very young man. He had experienced society as very isolating. He'd seen the way in which societies can turn on people who don't fit in. In his case, a lot of that was to do with poverty, but also to do with his sexuality. So he was very alert to that. He was very awake to that. And he started making work in his early 20s, began with photography, but he moved out into painting, films. He wrote a wonderful memoir called Close to the Knives, a couple of other books. He was sort of this extraordinarily prolific artist. And then in the late 80s, he was diagnosed with AIDS. Many of his closest friends died of AIDS, but one of them, the photographer Peter Hooja, died of AIDS. So he was experiencing isolation and loneliness then in a slightly different way, that it was about loss, but it was also about absolutely being demonized. This is the period where politicians are calling for people with AIDS to be tattooed with their status or to be put on islands. And he works to resist that, but also to articulate how these feelings of loneliness aren't necessarily personal responsibility. They're political. They're driven by all sorts of social forces that can be resisted.
We live alone, we die alone, as we hear. But my guest, Olivia Lang, says, I've come to believe that loneliness is not a wholly worthless experience, but one that cuts right to the heart of what we value and what we need. Her new book, Lonely City, explores loneliness, especially the work of artists who are profoundly lonely, but somehow connected through their work. That experience of a really painful or difficult childhood actually runs throughout the lives of some of the artists that you portray, like Henry Darger, who grew up in a home for the feeble-minded. Mm-hmm. He was a hospital janitor who left behind tens of thousands of pages of fiction and artwork. First, how was that discovered?
It's such a sad story, Henry Darger. He lived in a boarding house. He was a really socially isolated man. And just before he died, he, at around the age of 79, I think, he was moved to a Catholic mission home, actually the same mission home that his own father had died in. And he had stayed in this, he lived in this single room for decades and decades, and he was a hoarder, so it was absolutely crammed full of stuff, single shoes, eyeglasses, all these things that he picked up off the streets of Chicago. So understandably, his landlord wanted to clean it out, and he checked with Henry, and Henry was said, you know, you can throw the stuff away. So he got another tenant to help him do it. They got a skip. They started throwing things out. And gradually, as they went through this process, they began to find these paintings of supernatural radiance and strangeness, these extraordinary paintings of small girls. They document a civil war in an alternate world, and they're full of... some of them are very beautiful. They have kind of these dragon-like creatures. They have gardens full of flowers. And others show scenes of mass murder and mass torture. They're extremely striking. They're exquisitely coloured and they're very disturbing. And understandably, again, the landlord was sort of stunned by this work. He had no idea that Darja was an artist, and he had no idea really what to do with it. And it was him that drove Henry Darja's sort of posthumous recognition as one of the really great, unique artists of the 20th century.
The nature of his work, because of these images of little girls, often some of them glorious and heroic, others being killed. A lot of people look at this work and say, you know, that he was a pedophile, he was mentally ill. You seem more forgiving. Why?
I was kind of disturbed to the point almost of being enraged about the way that people spoke for him in his absence, about the way that people demonized him. And I really wanted to get to grips with that. So I spent some time in his archives reading his own journals. I wanted to really understand what his life had been and kind of what evidence there was for these sort of claims, aside from the content of his work, which is, let's remember, artistic work. So I really wanted to try and understand what had happened to him, what his life had involved. And it is just, like you said at the beginning, that there are people who have these fractured childhoods, and his was fractured beyond belief. He was, his mother died when he was very small. He was taken away from his father again when he was very young. He ended up in this home for feeble-minded children. He was an intelligent, clearly intelligent boy. Eventually, he got back to Chicago, and from the age of 17 till well into his 70s, he worked as a janitor, and yet who was astonishingly resourceful and committed in making artwork. He never earned very much money, and yet he managed to gather the resources to make these works, to come up with wonderfully inventive ways of solving problems in his work. And actually, it's very interesting to put him and Warhol together, because they have really similar interests in using pop culture, using images from comics and cartoons, using stuff from newspapers, replicating it, reproducing it, turning it into something else. And I think that sort of side of Darja has been really overwritten by the more salacious material, which there is no evidence for. There's no evidence that he was a pedophile or a serial killer. Absolutely zero.
Well, Darja did consider himself an artist, but he wanted his work burned, you know, and it's work that he obviously spent so much time on. But like you, you know, people get repelled by it until they dive in deeper. Mm-hmm. Hopper's paintings may be the same way. And I'm thinking, you know, Wanarovich, you know, craving human connection, but maybe not knowing quite how to do it and removed by his camera. There's this kind of push and pull tension with all of the artists that you look at. You know, they so want to connect with other people. So are we answering them? Are we connecting by looking at this work, by thinking about it, by talking about it?
When we're talking about loneliness, we often think that the solution is to find a relationship. And that, sure, there's truth in that, absolutely. But so much of it is a desire to be heard, to have our interiors seen in some way. And I think this is where art fits in, that people can communicate things that they can't necessarily say to another person into their artwork. And a person can see that artwork and be touched by it. And I found the expressions of loss, of hunger, of longing in these people's artwork incredibly healing, because it made me realise that my feelings weren't so strange after all, that there were other people who'd felt the same way. It dissolved the shame that I felt around my loneliness.
Well, how about you? I mean, you created this work about dwelling in loneliness, right? Breaking your own taboos and stigmas around loneliness and shame.
Yeah.
And coming to the other side of this, do you ever feel, you know, grateful to this man who so abruptly changed your life by backing out of this relationship in New York?
Wow, that's such an interesting question, because actually, if you'd asked me that even a week ago, I would have said no. And I think because I've been having to think about it so intensively over the last sort of, you know, the publication moment. Yes, I think I had an astonishing few years, a very painful few years, but I'm so grateful for being kind of smashed open enough to be able to have felt all of this and to have gone to those places. It really has been a blessing in a weird way.
Olivia Lang, thank you so much for speaking with us.
A great pleasure.
Olivia Lang is the author of The Trip to Echo Spring and most recently The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone. There's a link to more on the book, including what I think is a keenly accurate review by Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.